The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida.
Hi everyone, and we're back with Miami Memoirs, Strange Cases and Wild Tales with Louis Ress. I'm your host, Jeanette. Today's episode is called It's Good for a Drink, and it's episode 14. And if I don't know if you remember correctly, but Louis did mention that there was a bit of an airplane ride that he was in that was definitely worth a drink. And he had quite an experience. He's going to reveal to us what happened that day. So tell us what happened. You had mentioned that you were on a plane, a cargo plane, right? During your military service?
That's right. And It's Good for a Drink as a bet. It's about doing something that no one else has ever done. So that's good for a drink. Say I've done something that no one else has ever done or ever will do in the future. That's a little unusual. Mm-hmm. So Charles Lindbergh, that great American hero, was a military pilot similar to our astronauts. He graduated as a flying officer and ultimately became a male pilot. The death rate for male pilots, you know, United States male, was about 70%. Lindbergh had been a stunt pilot. He was a wing walker. You know, and they used to have these fairs and they'd go up in a twin wing plane, bi-wing plane, and he'd walk out on the wing while the plane was up in the air. And then he was a daredevil. He planned flying over the Atlantic Ocean in order to win a $25,000 prize. I'll tell you more about the prize.
Pretty hefty price for that time, right?
Yeah, it was. There was a scramble of pilots, and mostly was the publicity to break records. It was like the astronauts, they were going to go around the moon and they were going to land on the moon. Each one was trying to outdo the others, like Magellan trying to discover with Columbus to compete for discovering new territory.
Right.
So he was going to fly over the Atlantic, and there was a scramble of pilots and customized planes preparing to attempt this challenge. The Spirit of St. Louis was the result of successful fundraising. Lindbergh put his own savings of around $2,000 into it, which was a good bit of money at the time, into purchasing the single-engine plane for about $10,000. Well, everyone knows the rest.
Well, not everyone. What happened?
Well, over 150,000 Frenchmen rushed to the airport to see him arrive in Paris.
And was there an issue with how many people were there?
Yeah, it is. I don't know that it was 10 o'clock at night, 10:30 at night. I don't know that they came 10:30 at night, 8 miles out to the airport.
Yeah.
But I'll bet you a drink that I did something that only one other person in the world, in the past or in the present or in the future, could ever say they did. And that would be Lucky Lindy, Lindbergh. You'll never find anyone else who can say this. I flew over the Atlantic Ocean in the Spirit of St. Louis.
Oh. You did? How? That's crazy.
Well, it sounds crazy, but it's true. Sure, I can describe to you anything you like about the Spirit of St. Louis, having flown in it over the Atlantic Ocean. It was not covered in metal. It was actually covered in fabric, painted silver, except for the silver metal cowling covering the entire front of the plane. There was no front window. You looked out of a side window. The damn thing was a flying gas tank. It carried about 450 gallons, mostly in a large tank in the front of the airplane, right behind the engine.
Wow.
It also had two smaller tanks on the wings.
It's a lot of gas.
Well, it was for a little plane, a single-seater. There was one high wing, and it had the ID number NX211 in block letters on the top. The wheels were made of solid rubber. There were no steering wheel. It had a joystick, which I had to straddle. There was only one seat, and it was covered in fabric. And as I said, you had to look out the side to see where you were going. The rudder pedals were on either side of the stick.
This took almost 2 days, right? The voyage?
The voyage.
Your voyage across the Atlantic?
Well, you know, it actually took Lindbergh around 33 hours to go across nonstop. At that time, that's a long time to run a motor. There was a big issue as to the kind of motor you could have that could run for 50 hours they wanted it to run without stopping. And of course, that was a big feat mechanically. And there was no bathroom on the plane. There was a convenience jar. In other words, you urinated in the jar, and that was it. Now, do we have a bet? You want to bet a drink that I did it? Well, the drinks were on the bar. How the hell could this kid have flown in the Spirit of St. Louis over the Atlantic Ocean? He can't win that drink.
No,
he can't win that bet. Well, the story alone had to be worth the drink.
So what's the story?
Well, to make a long story short, I was in the Army. I was a first lieutenant. I was on leave trying to get back to New York City from Paris. They had told me to get out of town. Mm-hmm. My boss didn't want me around for a congressional investigation.
Right.
So I was in Paris. It was in 1955 or maybe early 1956. And the Orly Airport was about 9 miles south of Paris. And in the corner of that airport, on the north side, there was a small American base. And I had been stuck there for about 4 days when I asked operations about any flights to the U.S. Finally, the corporal told me to find Captain Jennings. He was flying a C-130 back to Mitchell Air Force Base on Long Island. Wow, just where I wanted to go. Jennings was having coffee in the PX. So I found him and he said, well, if you're in no rush, I'll be stopping in the Azores for a few days and then going on to Mitchell. Lord knows I've got plenty of room for you. Just be there at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. So, you know, we have to do customs or anything like that. It's military. So I show up.
What is, because you mentioned it was a C-130? What is that?
The C-130 Hercules is still in production. It's a cargo plane. It goes back to 1951, and it's the workhouse for the Air Force. It's a four-motored plane, and it can carry two Greyhound buses back-to-back.
Wow.
And along the walls, there were bed frames with webbing, and the frames would fold back into the sidewall of the plane. There were two big, long, canvas-covered objects, end-to-end, strapped to the deck of the plane. And we started to take off, and I actually couldn't feel any motion. It was so big that you didn't feel motion as it moved.
Hmm.
And it was as though it was standing still. And then we were airborne.
So did you fly nonstop?
Yeah, we landed at Largest Air Force Base in the islands in the Azores.
Hmm.
It's called Terceira Island.
Hmm.
And it was very interesting. Landing was very much the same. You didn't feel anything. It's this big thing comes down, but you didn't even know you're on the ground.
That's crazy.
And we had 3 days of sightseeing. They had to refuel and they had to clear through the Azores. So we had 3 days. And we looked at the whitewashed buildings. They were all white. And there were date palms. And there were lots of stone walls lining narrow roads. The roads were one lane. And they had stone walls on either side because they took the stones from the field and piled them up. And they had nothing to do with them. So they made them into walls.
Oh.
And the relationship with the United States and the Azores goes back to the Largesse Field, which goes back to World War I. The Portuguese had allowed our blimps to refuel there during the Atlantic crossing.
Oh, okay.
So Jennings, he was the captain, and his two-man crew were very friendly. And I asked what cargo we're carrying. They said, take a look for yourself. You'll be surprised. We had another flawless takeoff, and I was alone in this cavernous plane. So I started to remove the canvas. And sure enough, there was the Spirit of St. Louis and another ancient open-seated plane with their wings removed, all tied down to the deck and the wings stored on the side of the cargo hold.
And what did you do next when you saw that?
Well, I worked my way up to the cockpit, and Captain Jennings told me that they had just completed filming the Lindbergh story in Paris and that the Spirit of St. Louis was an exact replica. And that the second open cockpit plane tied down in the hold
mm-hmm.
was for photography.
Oh.
And they were returning the planes to the United States. He said, take a look at it, Lieutenant. Well, okay.
Did you look?
Yeah.
Before I would have.
Well, we were out over the Atlantic Ocean, way out, and I took the tarp and opened it up and took it off the plane. And I climbed into the Spirit of St. Louis. The name was printed right in black on both sides of the metal cowling. I climbed in. What the hell? No one was around. They said I could look at it. So I sat in the pilot's chair. It was a small fabric-covered lawn chair, you know, the aluminum lawn chairs, but it had no legs. And I straddled the joystick, And I put my feet onto the pedals, which were on either side, and I looked out the side window. The front view was non-existent. It was the back of a wall of a large fuel tank mounted in front of the cockpit.
Yeah.
And there were dials on it, and there was, you know, gauges on it, like a gas gauge and so on, and a speedometer. But
you couldn't see anything.
You couldn't see a thing. It was a wall. You actually had to lean out of the side window to look out. Lindley is said to have installed a small periscope, but I couldn't find any small periscope. How the hell this guy flew that plane all the way from Long Island to Paris through all kinds of weather and landed it at night without being able to see out of the front is beyond me.
Yeah, no, I can't. I don't even know how that's possible. And that was a poor design on a plane then. He couldn't even see through the front.
It was the only way they could do it, to put on the gas that he needed to fly.
Yeah, I guess so.
I think it was a nightmare. It was extremely dangerous. And remember, this is in 1927 with no guidance system, and he was landing in a strange airport and at night. The records show he landed at around 10:15, 10:30 at night. Anyhow, I flew in the Spirit of St. Louis over the Atlantic, and you'll never find anyone else who did. Oh, yes, we landed at Mitchell Field, right near Hempstead, Long Island.
So that's right where he took off, right?
Right, he took off. That was interesting. It was almost
very serendipitous.
And highly unusual, because it was Mineola, right? That's where he started. And we landed at night, and there were no customs, and there was no one to check anything, no luggage, no examination of my luggage. And I was back in Brooklyn to call my father, and he picked me and came out and picked me up, and I was back home in a matter of hours. I'll have that drink now, if you please.
Wow. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Lindbergh. Was he, quote, the great American hero that he was?
Well, now that you ask, I'll tell you a lot about Lindbergh. Lindbergh was 25 years old, and he was trying to win the Ortieg Prize. People had tried for 8 years. The prize was offered in 1919, and he won it in 1927. And it was, you had to fly from either the United States to Paris, New York to Paris, or Paris to New York. Either way, you could fly either direction. Well, the prevailing winds were such that you would fly over to England and then down to Paris. So six men died in three separate attempts and crashes trying to win the prize, and three others were injured in a fourth crash.
Wow.
So he had this experience before him of knowing that he was risking his life, that
yes.
was highly dangerous. Mostly it was the safety of the construction of the airplane. And when he went down the field to take off, this was out in Roosevelt Field. Roosevelt Field was out on Long Island. It's in Mineola, New York. And that used to be the Roosevelt Raceway. And I think they had trotters there. And then it became a huge shopping mall, which it is today. And that's where he took off. Ortieg was a hotel owner who was looking for publicity for his hotels. So Lindbergh did it. And today it was a $25,000 prize. So today the whole thing would be about $400,000. Well, he spent $10,000 on his plane. So if you figure it out, he would have spent like $180,000 on his plane to fly.
Should have definitely given him a bit more, I feel like. He was risking his life to do this. So.
Yeah, well, it was for fame, for publicity, too. He was a military officer, ultimately. He wound up a brigadier general. He got one star. He served from 1925, so he was in the military when he did this, to 1941. He was such a racist and an embarrassment to the United States government that they pretty much threw him out of the military during the war, the middle of the World War II. They threw him out.
And what kind of things did he do?
Well, he did a lot. First of all, he was pro-Nazi. He belonged to groups that were racist, that were fascistic groups. He belonged to America First, which is... Today, you make America great, and it sort of rings a bell. No one, they didn't want any involvement in the European war, in World War II, which was the same in World War I. He made a speech, which he said, Wall Street Jewish interests wanted the war for profits. He made that speech on September 11th, 1941, in Des Moines, Iowa.
Wow.
He had a Nazi philosophy, and he received a medal from Hermann Göring, the chief of the Air Force, Nazi Air Force, and he met with Adolf Hitler. He was a believer in eugenics.
Quite the guy.
I'm going to tell you more about eugenics. Eugenics meant that you did human breeding like cattle for the best superior race. Mm. Nazis adopted that from us. That came from America, eugenics, I think. Mm. And it was to weed out inferior people, which is the Nazi philosophy. And it's a crazy thing I'm going to tell you about eugenics. People didn't know about it.
Well, and the crazy thing is, too, that if you, and you see this even in, like, animals, if you breed with similar, like, too close of a lineage or a breed, then they come out with a bunch of problems. So it's not even the pure, quote-unquote, the pure the race or breed or person, the more problems that comes up, whether a disease or otherwise. So it's...
eugenics, in general, believed in the selective breeding of people, the way you do race horses and stuff.
Right.
To bring out the best traits. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you have inbreeding, that's something else. Mm-hmm. If you have limited breeding within a small group, a herd, mm-hmm. you always want to get cattle from outside your herd to come in and breed. You don't want inbreeding within your herd. And the same sort of thing. Well, these beliefs of eugenics were that it was a scientific racism. It was white supremacy, really. They wanted to have forced sterilization on criminals, insane, diseased people, disabled people, the poor. They wanted to have IQ tests for everybody, and the tests would determine if you were superior. They still do, and it's really silly stuff because it's how well you do on someone else's test.
Yeah.
It doesn't really tell you too much. But there was a lot of people, and they believed that the Nordic type, I keep telling you that the Nordics, German, Anglo-Saxon, were the superiors. And they should have immigration restrictions. And Margaret Sanger from Planned Parenthood actually was a believer in this.
Oh, seriously.
It's
I
a
didn't
big
know that.
Problem. Yeah.
Wow.
There's a lot of very famous people that got involved and they made mistakes and they said stupid things. There's a great black liberal leader by the name of Du Bois, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. W.B. Du Bois. Yeah.
Boy, you surprised me. I'm really impressed. He was a professor at Harvard, as I recall, and he had this top 10% idea. He was the founder of the NAACP.
Mm-hmm.
He's a wonderful human being.
Yes.
He was a great American, but he had a crazy idea that the top 10% of the blacks should mingle with the top 10% of the whites, and the top 10% of the blacks should intermarry or marry one another also. Of course, he also believed, and Margaret Sanger did too, about Planned Parenthood, that you shouldn't have more than two or three children, which is really an interesting argument. They also believed that you shouldn't have children if you had some type of a disease, that you might transmit it. They quoted the Bible, Psalms 16.6, "Yea, I have been goodly heritaged," or godly heritaged. Well, they believed in sterilizing women and men who didn't come up to standards. If you had had a psychiatric problem, over the cuckoo's nest, and they sterilized you. Women, black women, are still being sterilized against their will, without their knowledge. They go in for an OBGYN procedure, and they wind come out sterilized.
And the women that came out not too long ago, the women that are in the ICE camps right now, there was a nurse that came out.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That's just where it was, in the ICE camps.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It's still happening.
Right. Immigration enforcement. And that's where it was going on.
They're claiming that all these women have ovarian problems. And
right.
How can all these hundreds of women have the same problem and it have it be so severe that
they were being systematically sterilized.
They need their uses removed. It was horrendous.
And they also believed in this eugenics thing, mm-hmm. and this was Kellogg. It was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, the Harriman family, the Carnegie Institute. I mean, it really got crazy. You know, the guy that Rice Krispies, J.C. Kellogg?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was from Battle Creek, Michigan. he was deeply involved. He was the one that started it off, pretty much. He believed in body cleansing and eating cornflakes, you know, that kind of stuff. And you had to have a When you came in, you had an enema to clean your body out.
Oh, boy.
I forget what they were. High colonic. And you had Luther Burbank was involved in eugenics. And Alexander Graham Bell, the president of Stanford University. David Starr Jordan was involved in it. And I told you, Margaret Sanger, this is crazy stuff. Du Bois, you know, he was a great civil rights activist. So for him to say that the top 10% blacks should mix with the top 10% of whites, that's a dangerous concept.
Yeah.
And it would be, he called it the talented 10th. What I think it's good for the black community to remember is that everybody makes mistakes.
Yeah.
Everybody, nobody's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody says or does something at one point in their life that they shouldn't have done or said.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to forgive. You have to forgive that. You shouldn't forget it, but you should forgive it. And I keep saying that. Big difference.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, they said that women's function was at home. You know, the same old crap.
Yeah.
And that they should have birth control. And they wanted to limit Afro-Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans. They didn't want them to breed because they weren't the Nordic, Germanic people that we wanted in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what Lucky Lindy, had a lot of nicknames. And Lucky Lindy was involved with this kind of stuff. And he was a real Nazi. He was an anti-Semite. They called him Ned, Slim, the Lone Eagle, Lucky Lindy. Well, I'm Lucky Lewis. I get to ride in his plane and make stories. But he started off, by the way, he flew 2,000 miles with a total of a 10-mile error. He flew at night. He had the plane weighed over 5,000 pounds. It barely cleared the wires in the trees when it took off. It almost went down. He was wearing a white collared shirt and a tie. I'll tell you some interesting things.
Mm-hmm.
I saw the fuel being loaded from the top of the cabin going in. You know, this aerodrome that Roosevelt Field, by the way, was originally Hempstead Plains Aerodrome. They called it an aerodrome.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Hazelhurst Field and then the Roosevelt Field. And they had dirigibles there in 1919. So it was, you don't remember the dirigibles.
Nope.
The Hindenburg that went down in New Jersey in flames.
Oh, okay, yes.
They used the wrong kind of gas to float it, to make it airborne. Anyhow, tell you something else that nobody knows about. He didn't use a magnetic compass.
Hmm.
You had to have a compass to navigate.
Yeah.
How do you navigate
at
night alone in a single engine plane with no windows? And you can't even see the stars. You know, it's hard. So, what he did is he had a magnetic compass relates to the Earth's magnetic field.
Mm-hmm.
He had an Earth inductor compass, which was non-magnetic. It was invented in 1912, and it used the stars and a clock. And that's what he used.
Oh.
He used this compass, the clock, and the stars. He did it in 33 and a third hours. Yeah, I was right. And he went over St. John's, Newfoundland, and then to South Island, and then across England, and then over the Channel, and the winds were favorable. But he had to go up high, he had to go down low to avoid, you know, storms.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he flew just over the waves, other times he was up higher.
He was awake the entire time, right? Like, no sleep?
He couldn't sleep, no. 33 hours away.
I mean, you gotta hand it to him.
Yeah.
You know, he has a not so great racist background, but the guy did it.
You want to know some more stuff about him?
Yeah, sure.
That nobody knows. He had a child, you know.
Hmm.
He had the child
passed
was
away, right?
Kidnapped.
Oh yes,
you know,
that's
the
right.
Lindbergh kidnapping, and they have the Lindbergh law now. They call it
mm-hmm.
on the taking children across state lines or something, or
yes,
becomes a federal crime. Well, Hauptmann, I think, was the guy that kidnapped the child. They found the ladder and so on. There's a lot of questions as to the kidnapping. It was in his home in New Jersey, and they hadn't used the home. They were just building it, and they shouldn't have been there in the first place.
Huh.
And I don't know how the guy knew that they were there. But Lindbergh had six children with his American wife, who was a socialite.
Mm-hmm.
But he had, I would say, three illegitimate children in Germany with his private secretary and her two sisters.
Oh, Lindy.
That's a good way to end. You never heard that before.
No.
You don't see that in the history books.
Oh, boy. away, Lindy.
So lucky Lindy had quite a life. And he was finally such an embarrassment to the Army Air Force that they threw him out in 1941.
Wow.
Okay, does that help you?
Yeah,
yep. And Hauptmann got the electric chair, by the way. Mm-hmm. And the baby was cremated, mm-hmm. and the ashes were scattered over the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Very sad story. Well, thank you so much, Louis, for sharing your tale of flying on the Spirit of St. Louis across the Atlantic. Until next time, then.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed it. And I'm glad that I was able to fly in the Spirit of St. Louis. I haven't won too many drinks. People are skeptical. Thank you.